Thursday,
October 4th, 2018. Everyone's eyes are really widening. Is it my levels or just the date?
It's the date. No, it's okay. The date.
Can you believe
we've got like a month till the election is what I keep thinking about, right?
Yes. So
I was just gripped by the momentousness of what we're about to do.
I know. Yeah. It's really dawning on me.
Yeah.
Joint production, LA podcast, Gimme Shelter, the California Housing Podcast. We need a subtitle.
California Housing Crisis Podcast.
Yeah, you should get the title right.
Yeah. Well, you guys that should, in case the housing crisis ends and you want to keep the podcast going, just for longevity.
We didn't think
you'd probably change.
You've got another couple decades max.
Yes. Or if we run out of housing, you might want to drop housing.
just the crisis podcast.
I'm Hayes Davenport, Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker from LA Podcast, and we've got Liam Dillon from the LA Times and Matt Levin from Cal Matters from Gimme Shelter, the California Housing Crisis Podcast.
This is the most likely crossover event in history.
We've been circling each other for a while. Yep. Yeah, very, yes.
So you guys have seen the picture of the Power Rangers and the Ninja Turtles crossing over. I'm just staking out ground that we're the Ninja Turtles.
Okay.
And you guys can be the Power Rangers.
Okay.
Each of you is covering two Ninja Turtles?
Yes. yes.
I'm Raphael. You can have the rest, Liam. That's fine.
That's okay. Yeah.
Well, we just to get our joint production going, you guys have a lot more recurring segments than we do. You're savvier than we are in terms of production. We only have one, really,
okay.
Which is we each tell an LA story at the beginning of the podcast. But in the interest of time, I thought we could just have Liam tell one from his current visit to LA.
Yeah, you were in town. Yeah.
An LA story that's evocative,
right?
Who sort of encapsulates everything about being in the city.
And possibly provocative,
yes,
if you want.
Always. So far, they've all been very provocative.
So this is probably pretty hacky. But on my Lyft ride from the Times studio or Times new offices in El Segundo to downtown where we are, my Lyft driver was a director, actress, writer, which is I think common.
Uh huh.
Right? See how hacky? He doesn't like it. And
classic out of towner LA story.
I know, right? That's why I feel like this is a joke, right? And really showing my actual lack of knowledge of Los Angeles, which is a shame. So it's a fascinating little movie she's done about a fictionalized version of a 2014 law in Uganda where they banned miniskirts.
Okay.
Wow.
And the results of that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did she give you a flash drive? They should just have them on a flash drive, just in a little bag with the mints and the...
Exactly.
Or screen the trailer, the like yes, on a video right, screen. Yeah.
Right.
So I was just like, wow, this must be what it's like to live here.
We should do a table read.
Well, welcome, Liam, and welcome, Matt, via Skype to L.A., should we do an avocado of the week? Do you want to introduce your avocado of the week segment?
Fortnite.
Oh, that's right. It's a Fortnite now.
You know, every other week.
Of course. That's right.
Avocado of the Fortnite.
Liam,
this is sort of,
Liam, sorry to interrupt. Do you want to, for the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of listeners that may not know of Gimme Shelter, do you want to give like a little spiel about what we do and how tolerable our podcast is?
This is a good idea. This is why you're in charge. Every couple of weeks, we produce a podcast taking a look at some of the deeper issues behind California's housing affordability problems with a lens predominantly through kind of state policy. But we talk about all the ballot initiatives you're going to be voting on. We talk about legislation. We talk about how that affects regular people. And it's a good time.
And we also talk about ballot initiatives.
Yes, I guess we should make the case for LA podcast
See,
as well.
See, that was a transition, transition.
To Gimme Shelter listeners. We talk about all that stuff too, but specific to LA. And we also talk a lot about local transit, schools, police, all kinds of local politics, stuff that is relevant to the people who live here.
Yeah, for our LA listeners who only understand things in movie analogies, we kind of have a zoomed out and then far wide frame and then zoomed in dynamic going on with the California Housing Crisis podcast and LA podcast.
Yeah.
This episode.
Good. That's good.
That's good.
That's right. And do you want to describe the avocado of the Fortnite segment that you guys do?
So it's a sort of humorous but insightful moment that that takes a look at kind of an interesting anecdote that describes a larger truth.
Okay.
About housing problems.
And how did it get that name?
Sure. So the Fortnite part came from a loyal listener who every time we said avocado of the week would tweet us and say, but you guys only come on every 2 weeks. You should really
fix this. They were trying
to
get you. They were trying to get you back weekly.
Like. Yeah.
The avocado part came from a Australian developer who a couple years back now said that the reason millennials could not afford to buy homes was because we, I think I'm fair in saying we, is everyone here a millennial?
No, I'm not. Sorry.
Ooh. Oh, so, okay. All right. Well,
it's an exclusive.
I'm a baby boomer.
You're a millennial in spirit. The Australian developer said the reason millennials can't afford to buy homes was because they spend too much money on avocado toast, which is empirically true. You know, he had a study, used a couple instrumental variables and just conclusively showed that we were spending way too much on avocado toast and thus could not afford home. So it's in that spirit that we pick something that's hopefully amusing or whimsical or also kind of a lighter side of the housing crisis, although this specific avocado of the Fortnite veers into...
No whimsy here.
It's one of the darkest,
this is the
brownest, ugliest
this
avocados.
Is real bad.
The one when you cut into it and you just know right away.
Yeah, that it's like
this
moldy
one is going
almost on the edge.
Directly into
yeah.
the compost.
It's got like those strings in it. You know what I'm talking about? Like some of them.
Oh, yeah.
They're like stringy. Yeah.
It's a Philadelphia avocado, Liam.
Oh. I don't have a response from that. I don't have a response to that because he's true. It's true. So. In fact, whenever I go home back to Philly, my whole family says you need to bring us a dozen avocados.
I love that. Yeah. That feels like the old, like in the boom town era of LA, you would send up like orange crates to
crates.
Everyone you knew.
And
people had never seen these weird fruits before.
Yeah.
Like the Colombian exchange almost.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So let's talk about this Fortnite's avocado.
So we'll talk more about the idea of citing homeless shelters and in Los Angeles, but there's been a lot of meetings about doing this.
We have talked about this extensively. Yeah. In particular, there was one in Koreatown that was announced. We did probably four episodes about it. This is part of Eric Garcetti, the mayor's A Bridge Home project in which each of our 15 council districts was going to build a temporary shelter and also be required to build a certain amount of permanent supportive housing. And the first temporary shelter that was announced was in Koreatown, right by the subway station there at Wilshire in Vermont. And it generated huge protests, marches.
Everything short of a literal firestorm, I would say, you could attribute to this.
Yes.
And they threatened to recall the council member, which we'll go back to again later as well. But it was bad.
And it resulted in that shelter being moved. A lot of papers, including your own, Leah, reported it as moving within Koreatown, but it actually, or on the outskirts of Koreatown, it actually moved out of Koreatown entirely into the Westlake MacArthur Park area. And I believe the second shelter to be announced was in Venice in Mike Bonin's district. And that also generated a lot of protests. And then the third was in Sherman Oaks in David Rue's district.
Hollywood. CD13 is in Hollywood.
Right.
And Hollywood is breaking ground next month.
You know why I missed it? Was because...
No protests.
I have to credit CD13 and Mitchell Farrell's office. They did a really good job with outreach. And I think that it's pretty clear, like, where it has to be in that neighborhood as well.
I hope nobody listening to this is like, what?
Sorry, it's already breaking ground.
But we wanted to talk about specifically the Sherman Oaks.
Sherman Oaks, big public meeting, people not happy. And one of those who were not happy was a gentleman named Rick Marcelli. And I'll just read from an LAist article that described what Mr. Marcelli had to say about the homeless shelter in Sherman Oaks. Rick Marcelli draws a distinction between homeless residents in need of help, a helping hand, which he supports, and those he calls, quote, criminal transients. Either way, he argues that, quote, tough love is the answer. You already comply as a citizen, as a taxpayer, or you don't, he said. You want me to have compassion for people who don't care about themselves? The lifelong Los Angeles resident has an extreme alternative. Have the federal government step in and move them out of the urban area. Quote, I'm proposing maybe you build a reservation for these homeless somewhere out in the desert with all the help that they can be given. He said, when we interned the Japanese during the Second World War, we didn't intern them in the city.
Pretty.
Whoa.
Like maybe the most shocking thing I've seen for attribution.
Yeah.
In like a local, like a local outlet in a long time. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's really, really horrifying.
Yes.
But not too dissimilar from in the lead up to the 84 Olympics, what we reported on at Curbed. One of the city council members before the 84 Olympics wanted to send the drunks and the vagrants, as in his words, out to a farm camp so they could sweat it out and use their bodies for labor, I think was some of the quotes from that. So not a new idea.
And actually, when we were talking a couple of weeks ago about the Koreatown shelter and the fight that that engendered, there were similar comments by a pastor in Koreatown who was part of the like broader Keep Koreatown movement, who actually said something very similar with regards to why don't we take all of the homeless people and move them outside the city limits? I think which you could basically understand to be outside of LA
like
County.
Like West Hollywood. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think he really meant out of the region. Right. And, you know, people have issues with understanding where LA ends. But like, but yeah, that sort of notion of kicking people out of the urbanized area is around. It's definitely in the air. And it's really frightening that people think you can just move individuals like that against their will and, without regard to their safety
and intern them in
and literally invoke one of the darkest periods of American history in a positive light as a solution.
I think as we basically do have internment camps right now for people who are being detained.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that would be expressed, couched in, I care about these people. We have to do something for
tough
them.
Tough love.
Yes. Yeah. That our discourse right now is so anti-homeless that would be seen as like an appropriate thing to say to a reporter. I think it's almost helpful that the subtext is kind of becoming text in this way. I think it is... There's so much coded messaging when people talk about people who are homeless about we have to do this is just not the right place to put them. We need to like do something that will actually help them rather than things that will enable them. Right. When secretly the only response that a lot of these people would be okay with is putting people in jail or just shipping them out of the city entirely or both in this guy's case. So because if you don't think that's an appropriate, humane response, there are certain people in this conversation who just kind of can't really be engaged with. At some point, there's a certain population of like a lot of homeowners, especially that you just kind of have to ignore when it comes to taking care of people who are homeless.
The interesting thing that Matt and I talk about a lot is the homeless discussion at the state level is almost entirely about money. Like we need to provide money and give money to the cities and the counties so they can do all the things that they want to do. But what that ignores at the state level is like actually citing something is a huge, huge, huge issue. Mm-hmm. And you could throw all the money in the world at it, but unless and until someone's willing to say, let's put this in my backyard or here, then the money doesn't matter.
Yeah, we here, I think, have a lot more money right now than we're able to spend. Eventually, I'm sure all that money will be spent.
Right.
But how many HHH projects are...
To tell our audience what HHH is. Yeah.
HHH was a ballot measure that was passed, I want to say, on Election Day 2016. That allocated over $1 billion billions across multiple years towards new housing for people who are homeless, permanent supportive housing
in LA.
In LA, yes, LA City. I believe one of those projects, two of those projects have broken ground. Lots are coming,
but
lots are being held up.
We can talk more about that. I think we're going to talk more about that as well. But yeah, being held up, but also this idea that, yeah, that the council members themselves can be the ones who say, you know, not there, you know, not in my district.
Yeah. the money's there right now to put up units. It's not a matter here anyway of allocating more money. It's much more about public opinion in terms of figuring out places to put this housing.
In your guys' conversations of homelessness in other parts of the state of California, have you run across a lot of sentiments like this? We know that like LA has an even more exacerbated homelessness crisis than other parts of the state and country. But I wonder if these sentiments are reflected elsewhere or if we really are an outlier in terms of people having this really visceral reaction to finding places to house the homeless.
I think it's each place has its own challenges, and all of the challenges I'm thinking particularly of San Francisco and San Diego are also great. I mean, San Diego had a hepatitis A outbreak,
right?
You know, because they weren't able to address in a meaningful way the homeless population there. San Francisco, you know, we could talk a lot about all the sorts of things that are going on with a number of folks who are in the streets and discussions of even putting up a safe injection site as a part of the long-term homelessness solution is a certain population that would be served by that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think each big city in the state has its own challenges that are pretty stark in this area.
Yeah, LA is by no means unique with this type of opposition. And then just to broaden it out, not just to either temporary or permanent housing for people experiencing homelessness, but just affordable housing broadly, the degree to which people are explicit in their bias against low-income Californians in these city council meetings is extraordinary. So the last podcast that Liam and I did, we talked about a project in Cupertino where an individual that was opposing the project literally put on a PowerPoint slide, because this project, about half the units were going to be reserved for low and moderate income people, the PowerPoint slide literally said, if we bring these people into our community, they have a lower level of education and it will not be good for us.
Yeah, so it was arguing like it will make us uncomfortable or something, right?
Yeah, that was
like,
the exact language, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I also just want to reinforce what Hayes said. I think when this type of explicit bias is out there, I think it's actually good for those that want to build more of this housing, because nobody wants to be on the side of the guy who is invoking Japanese internment camps as an example of what to do, right? I think these types of things are actually good in that way.
I never thought about it like that.
Well, I think for the pro-housing people, it does give you something to point to
exactly. And
just say, this right. is what we're up against.
Exactly.
And I think actually I don't want to, it wasn't a riot. It was almost a riot. And in Sherman Oaks, when David Rue, the council member, was there, that generated a pro building the supportive housing response event. And so I think this kind of thing can be good. Yeah, can galvanize people. But I think it's still the case. We talk about this kind of thing a lot in LA. I think it's true in a lot of cities. I think the majority of people that live in the city are pro giving the services and the housing to people who are homeless that they need, but they are not as vocal as the people who are against it. So I think we have the numbers in favor of doing something like this, but the volume is out of proportion.
Something else from that meeting that was pretty troubling was that, you know, David Rue gets up there and starts talking about this and people start chanting recall, which is now, I guess, what groups of people do.
Can we back up and just explain what this meeting was and
and
what happened there, Alyssa?
Yeah. I mean, it was it was the same meeting. I don't even think that they were specifically there to talk about the site of the shelter or anything. You know, a site hadn't been determined even yet. So there were a couple of maybe options on the table, just
they
like as
two,
any.
I think that they
yeah,
were considering.
I mean, but it wasn't even like totally determined yet. And the council member was there, I think, for other things as well. It wasn't just for this particular thing. But it's been a similar thing, and it's been a similar outcome in many meetings that we've seen, from anything from road diets to, which we've talked about on our show, to again, like the siting of a homeless shelter. And, you know, they get up there and they try to present, we have this need, they show data, we have this amazing homelessness count that shows where people are experiencing homelessness and where the numbers show that most people are living on the streets. And they pick sites that are either city owned properties. They LA Times actually did a great story of like picking out over 100 sites across the city that would be good for these shelters that were on city-owned parking lots. And in most cases, this little parcel that has, you know, had been discussed is very close to the freeway. It's unused land. It's nothing that is maybe in front of people's businesses or anything that would trouble anyone, you know, close to the freeway. I was like having like, you know, concerns about it being so close to the freeway and like the horrible air pollution and the fact that we'd even build housing there. But this is the land that's available. And when he got up to discuss it, some of the neighbors started chanting recall. And he was like, wait, we're not even decided anything yet. And I think that that's a super dangerous knee-jerk reaction.
But it's been rewarded in the past.
That's
and this
right.
is the cost of, for example, moving the Koreatown location on threat of recall to Herb West and the council member in that district. I saw there's a change.org petition to move the Sherman Oaks sites now, or to stop the housing from being
just stop
built
it.
There.
I don't even think they care
just
about
stop
it. Yeah,
yeah
just
they
stop.
Don't care. Just yeah. Yeah. It's being put up by the guy that owns the auto body shop across the street from the site on Dickens in Sherman Oaks, where the permanent supportive housing would go. And I saw a lot of comments, people saying we should do what they did in Koreatown. We have to just be relentless about this until they move this site. The recall threat also worked against Councilmember Mike Bonin when he put in a road diet in Playa del Rey. That how long did that road diet last?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, you can get into that another time. But yeah, but basically
but
they reversed
that,
it.
The fact
yeah.
that they caving on these things emboldens everybody else.
So now the threat of recall has become like this rallying cry. And that's
yes.
somebody has to stand up for this. And our mayor was out of town again, which is another problem that we
and
can
talk
about.
This is his initiative.
This is his initiative.
And it's imploding. So
we just have to vent a little bit, you guys. Like, just let it, you know.
Yikes. No, it's just, I mean, you know, but again, like as I was saying before, the fact that, you know, we are able to talk about what people in Sacramento are talking about and high level stuff about, well, it's not getting built or the numbers are bad or whatever. But when it comes down to it, the system that we have in California in particular is the locals decide what goes where and whether anything gets built at all. And that's the reality. So no matter, again, how much money Sacramento throws at the issue or locals even throw at the issue, at the end of the day, in order to put sticks in the ground, someone has to say yes.
So should we talk about the governor's amazing mandate, I guess, for what LA council members specifically have to do now?
So this is really interesting. So this is this legislation that was authored and now signed by Governor Brown began with an LA Times story by my great colleague Emily Alpert, writing about the fact that individual council members here have essentially a pocket veto over permanent supportive housing projects in their districts, where they can. In order for a project to be eligible for money, which is essential to these projects getting built, there has to be a sign-off, essentially, for that individual council member. And that has held up projects in the past, the lack of that sign-off, in a way that's not particularly transparent, right? No vote, no nothing, just doesn't exist.
And for any reason in the world.
For any reason. There's no, yeah.
They've been Curran Price, the council member, vetoed a project on Florence Ave in South LA just because it looked too boxy. He wanted some of the bedrooms to be bigger, and the developer was like, I can't. That doesn't pencil out if they're bigger. And so, yeah, Curran Price put the letter in his pocket, and it never got done. Mm-hmm. Monica Rodriguez, I think, wanted the color scheme changed on a building in Sylmar. So it's all all.
But do you think they really wanted those changes?
Who am I to say?
Here we are gathered to mourn one of the many unilateral levers that you get as an LA City Council member. The power is just not what it used to be. But I think it's great that California stepped in. Because this is one of the areas where actually several times in the past X number of sessions, we've had state senators and legislators make proposed changes to the way that government is administered here in LA, only to have LA local officials say, that's not fair. You know, we're capable of reining in our own government on our own, but yet things like this pocket veto, they just seem to persist year after year until the state actually does something about it.
So what's interesting about this legislation is normally when you have legislation that affects a certain region of the state, a representative of that region of the state is the one who sponsors it.
Yeah.
In this case, that was not true. With Assemblyman David Chu, who's from San Francisco, he's the head of the Assembly Housing Committee, so certainly someone who's very active on housing issues. He's the one who wrote the bill that said no state money for your project, any city, if you have this sort of pocket veto system.
But it was a clear shot.
Oh, it was absolutely inspired by LA. He wasn't hiding that. It was totally inspired by LA and wanted to end the practice in LA. And usually, again, you have a co-author from LA or something. Didn't happen here, and somehow it made it through the process and the governor signed it. So that means if LA wants state money for housing projects, they have to change the way they do things.
And I think it's important to say, though, that there is, no matter how many of these state housing programs get passed to fund homeless housing projects, there is going to be a finite amount of money to go around. LA, with its enormous homeless population, necessarily gets a lot of the funds that come out of any state program. So it makes sense for the other counties in the state to want to level the playing field with LA, make sure that the money that accrues in LA is actually going to be able to get spent, not just pile up. And if not, then they can use that money for something in their districts. I think it only makes good sense, and I'm glad that somebody proposed it.
I mean, is there any city that you think is doing a really good job? I mean, have you guys have been reporting on these issues? Like, is there a California city that is a model for this?
We get asked that question a good amount, and there's always an awkward silence, like there just was.
A little sigh.
We can edit it, so it'll be long, even longer.
Just more awkward silence. So the truth is I don't know of an exemplary city. Liam, I don't know if you have cities that you know of that are doing it better than others. We get asked this a lot, and we don't have any good answers, really.
There are some folks in Silicon Valley who will swear to me that their bond system that they passed a couple of years ago is working out very well. So take that for what it's worth. Obviously, there's tremendous housing challenges in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But at least in this respect, people are tell me all the time that they should be seen as a model for how to get money and then how to spend it.
Sorry, I know that wasn't satisfactory at all, but that's...
Not good. Well,
it's what I expected you to say.
So you guys are both based in Sacramento, which mm-hmm. I visited earlier this summer, and I was interested to see so much infill development, like a lot of housing being built, or at least it looked like it. Like, what's it like in Sacramento, especially since so many of these legislators are there, living there and maybe, impacting what's going on there.
Yeah, well, there's definitely been a boom in infill development the last couple of years. At the same time, I guess 2015 and 2016, the average rent increase in Sacramento topped the national list of mid-sized cities. So you didn't really see a connection yet between the significant amount of building and the... a drop in rent prices until this year. Sacramento saw a marginal increase in rents, and it was mostly attributed to the significant amount of building that's been happening. In terms of kind of the culture of opposition to new building, I'd be interested to get your take on this, Liam. I think there's less of this, at least in urban Sacramento than there are in certain parts of LA and certain parts of the Bay Area. But that's just a broad, relatively uninformed take. But you don't see the same type of heated opposition to, you know, the new 8-story building that's going up in Midtown that you would see in the Mission, for example, or that you would see in Boyle Heights or something like that.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I also think that there has been a lot more agitating that you, in Sacramento recently than as you see around the state. There's a big, tenant groups there tried to put a rent control measure on their ballot. They were not successful, but they were successful in convincing the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg, who is a former leader of the state Senate, so very plugged into what was happening in the state, to consider some rent stabilization measures. And depending on what happens with the Proposition 10, the rent control expansion on the ballot, sort of go either way. But that was something he was not open to before. And I think he's been pushed by tenant groups to say now it's something that he wants to consider.
Excellent transition.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to say that was a well-crafted transition.
We had some news. We've talked about both of our podcasts have talked a lot about Proposition 10 on the November ballot to repeal Costa Hawkins. We've talked a lot about what Costa Hawkins is, how it restricts rent control expansion across the state. But there was some news on Proposition 10. The only poll that I have seen, was it the only one that's been done?
Only public poll that's sort of worth a salt. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, do we talk about this poll, Liam?
So the Public Policy Institute of California, which is a nonpartisan group well-respected across the state, released their poll in September. And it was a bit surprising, given, I think, what people have generally believed about the popularity of rent control, because while it did show that in general, like we've seen before, rent control is popular, it is sort of 52% support in that poll. Proposition 10, however, is not per the poll. I mean, it only had 36% support, 48% opposed, and 16% undecided. And that's really, really difficult number for proponents to say, you know, we're in good shape, because it's the opposite.
Including a majority of renters.
Right. And that was, you getting the crosstabs about some of the people who said this is good or bad. And the fact that you have the majority of renters saying no to this initiative is, again, a sort of probably the most stunning finding, I think, from the poll. Again, only one poll, but these guys are well-respected, well-known. We'll see what future polls have to say, but certainly not a good starting point for the proponents.
Yeah. So, I mean, tenant protections do pretty well nationally. California obviously has its own political restrictions to contend with. Costa Hawkins isn't something that necessarily exists anywhere else. But it is very surprising to see that 51% of renters would be against this. Do you guys have any hypotheses about why that might be the case?
So there's a couple. Yeah, well, do you want to start?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think I only have one point, and I think it's the one you're going to make, Liam. And
I had two, so you can do the one, and then I'll do the other one. Okay.
This time, I get to make the point before Liam does. It's rare on the podcast that that's what happens. Also, is this still Prop It Like It's Hot, or...
We already did a big prop lock and drop it for this. So
this is like a reprop.
Yeah.
I don't know if you would,
Okay, so my scorching hot take on the Prop 10, the fairly dismal Prop 10 showing, how you ask a poll question matters. That's very obvious, but in this case, it is especially true. And I'm just going to read you what the PPIC poll actually asked respondents.
Okay,
and keep
so, like,
mind,
pretend you got the call, okay, yes, right? Everybody
I'm,
put
I'm
your...
extremely low information.
Maybe on your... Do we know if it was landline
it's
or...
Both.
Okay, both. Okay, that's important too, right?
They're legit.
So,
they're
okay.
Legit. They're
okay.
Both.
Yeah. Yes. Ring, ring.
Yeah.
Ring, 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 ring. Hello.
Hey.
I just hang up instantly.
Goodbye. Damn it. I was already... I'm busy. Okay, go ahead.
Do you want to ring ring again?
Hi, pollster.
Hi, do you have nothing to do for the next 20 minutes?
I do. I have nothing to do.
Perfect. So this is the actual question that they asked. Prop 10 is called the Expands Local Government's Authority to Enact Rent Control on Residential Property
No.
It repeals state law that currently restricts the scope of rent control policies that cities and other local jurisdictions may impose on residential property. The fiscal impact is potential net reduction in state and local revenue of tens of millions of dollars per year in the long term. Depending on the actions by local communities, revenue losses could be less or considerably more. If the election were held today, would you vote yes or no? So
you made it sound real bad.
Yes, that's a total no for me.
So the reason it's phrased like that is because it's supposed to mimic what people are going to initially see on their ballots. And the fiscal impact is going to be one of the first things that they see. So there's a reason PPIC did it this way. But this at least partly explains the disparity between the approval for Prop 10 and the approval for rent control broadly that Liam just described, right? The other thing go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, absolutely. I think if you hear that on the phone, it sounds like there is a huge amount of uncertainty that if I were somebody who were unfamiliar with it to start with, I would say, I don't know. why would I vote for this?
Also, Prop 6, which is also the gas tax repeal, also a yes on a repeal.
Exactly.
Also ate it
exactly.
In this poll.
Yes.
It's confusing to vote yes because you want to get a law no'd.
Right.
Is complicated. And I think with all these ballot measures, you kind of have to assume the dumbest reason possible for why.
In the same poll, did they ask about rent control? Like, what was that question? Do you have that language of like what? And that's how they knew that where there is the disparity between actual.
I don't know if you have the question, but that's where they got the 52% number.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
in support.
I do if you want to.
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Do the phone call skit.
Okay.
Do you think rent control, that is the ability of local governments to set limits on how much rents can be increased each year, is a good thing or a bad thing?
Why? It's a good thing.
I'll put you in the yes category.
you would join 52% of people saying that.
So why did they lead? So we know they led with the other question, and then you could have just hung up at the first part anyway. So
right,
we even got to the second question.
I do want to add. So this is just likely voters, right? So if there is some huge wave of progressives, a lot of which would be disproportionately tenants or renters, you know, that maybe this changes a little bit, but 51% just pro rent control is not that great a starting place.
No. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
it's not.
That precedes an avalanche of negative advertising from the incredibly wealthy apartment association. So, all right. Yeah. Hopefully, I took away all of Liam's points.
You took the one, and then Hayes took the other one about the yes for repeal. So I don't got anything left to say except I can expand on the money now because we're transitioning.
Yes.
So, 3.5-1 in terms of the latest financial reports in which landlord lobby is outraising the proponents of Prop 10. I don't think that disparity is surprising in any way, shape, or form.
Of course they are.
Of course they are, right? But I think, again, given the amount of ground that it looks like proponents have to make up to tell people, actually, if you vote yes, I mean, this means more rent control potentially. When you're avalanched by people saying, no, this is bad, and that's what you're going to see in your mailbox and on your television, again, it's such a big hole for them to have to climb out of.
Now, I got to say, after we talked about this on our podcast the other day, I really looked in vain to try to find out what AHF, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, who introduced this. We talked about how Michael Weinstein introduced this measure and how they've really been supporting it, like looked at how they were trying to sell it to the people. And I really didn't see even the same level of campaign materials and infiltration of public space that I did with even Measure S. So I'm curious if you guys have even seen, like, what have you seen? The most of the stuff I've seen about 10 has been from like my friends who are working on these issues, but I can't say I've seen like a huge yes on 10 push. Do you guys agree?
If you Google Prop 10, I personally get an avalanche of no Google ads.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, billboards.
mean, but not even that many, and not even many good ones.
Are any of the AHF billboards still up? I mean, I think they've pretty much all been converted by now, right?
Well, I still see some that are like STD. I still see some gonorrhea tsunami ones.
I wonder if that's because during Measure S, they saw an actual syphilis explosion.
So, why don't we back up for our listeners who are like, what on earth is going on? So,
you don't think our listeners are familiar with a gonorrhea explosion, Liam?
That was a gonorrhea tsunami.
Oh, tsunami.
Syphilis explosion.
What's the quickest possible way to explain this? It's really not easy. The sponsor of Proposition 10 runs an organization called the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is most famous for in Los Angeles for these very cheeky billboards that advertise their STD testing services. Some of which show this apocalyptic volcano with the text syphilis explosion. Some of which just have a giant condom on them, things of that nature. Pretty much all of those have been converted now to say yes on 10.
But not all of them, I'm telling you. Yeah, I've seen.
So, I mean, that is true that there has been obviously less, I would say, media saturation for the yes on 10, even as compared with the Measure S campaign, as you both said.
Which was a slow growth measure in LA that failed early 2017. March, yeah.
Yeah. However, I mean, we do see in the poll that LA is the single region where there is the most support for Prop 10. Right. So I don't know if there's a relationship
so
there.
So they know that we're in, so they're maybe focusing their money somewhere
I don't
else.
Know. I mean, it does make sense that that is where most of their property, like where their billboards are and things like that. I don't know if that is the reason why or if it's because LA is, compared to the urban centers in the north, a considerably lower income.
So I've 2 points, maybe 3 points. One is, if you look at their financial... Thanks.
Matt's used to it.
Okay. Right. Here
he's
we
like,
go.
Only
here
comes two? The point. Only three?
Only three. So on the one hand, if you look at their financial reports, their campaign numbers, they've burned through a lot of money. So they've raised $13 million, but spent, you know, more than 12. And so that means they don't have a ton left to spend. Second, you tend to see spending really ramp up or things sort of appear when everyone gets their ballots. And that doesn't happen until next week. So I would not be surprised to see sort of more of an avalanche of pro, particularly if you have limited funds, then that's when you want to focus your attention and your time, right? When someone gets their ballot. The third thing, I don't know if you guys were surprised about this too, but the Bay Area numbers in this poll were really, really poor.
Very low.
And really low. And that was another sort of really shocking finding that folks in the Bay Area, which have been dealing with this crisis as much as anybody, did not tend to support this measure as high as other areas.
I personally thought it was staggering, the difference in support level between LA and everywhere else, essentially, especially considering LA, I think, is typically seen as a not super... I don't think that we're seen as the locality that is going to rock the boat in terms of pushing for progressive policy. That is more something that you would associate with San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley, et cetera. But that's not the case here.
It's possible that they have another maybe source of advertising that we've talked about. If you want to be cynical about it, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation runs a group of thrift stores called Out of the Closet. And in Los Angeles, those are all closing. There's one in Echo Park that closed.
Oh, no.
There's one in Hollywood.
That's super upset.
The one right on Sunset in Hollywood is closing. And I believe there are signs up now that say like closing because the rent is too high or something.
I think that one in Echo Park for sure said that. The other one is being sold to a being developed into a tower, which I'm sure is some kind of statement, could be used as some kind of statement as well.
So maybe people are reacting to their favorite stores closing. Here's a question. This is a question that I have about Prop 10. This could potentially be very bad for the rent control movement in general. If this gets on the ballot, if it's left up for voters and it doesn't go through, it does set back the movement pretty substantially. A lot of bills get pulled off the ballot because the proposers of the proposition make some kind of deal with the legislature. This happened with a bunch of bills this cycle.
Right.
I know David Chu and Richard Bloom in the Assembly had proposed to repeal Costa-Hawkins earlier this year. So they tried to get something through the legislature already. But was there ever any discussion about a deal being made, but from the people pushing Prop 10 and the legislators? Was that do you guys get the sense that that was ever on the table to try and work out some kind of compromise?
Yes and no. So, yes, there were negotiations between the Apartment Association and Weinstein and his allied tenants groups. This happened in
May?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Mm-hmm. We harmonized on that. And the reason I say yes and no is, so yes, as a fact, there were phone calls and some type of back and forth. The reason I say no is because they really didn't make any progress on those negotiations whatsoever. Okay. The tenant side and the landlords were too far apart. And part of the complication was the Apartment Association, which was leading the negotiations on the no on 10 side, they weren't just representing landlords. They were representing huge corporate entities that now rent out single family homes, like Blackstone,
which is a
private equity firm that owns a lot of real estate in Southern California, actually. I'm blanking on the other interest group that developers writ large, and realtors. So it was hard for them to kind of coordinate a single bargaining position. So yes, there were discussions. Were they real? From my understanding, not really.
And to your point, Hayes, too, it's not just the tenant groups who had a lot to sort of gain from a potential deal. Certainly the landlords did, too, because if Prop 10 were to pass, that's potentially 500 rent control campaigns across the state that they have to fight, right?
Expensive.
With a lot of money and a lot of different, sort of nuances in each individual community. And so there was certainly some incentive for them to come to the table, too. Yeah.
The Blackstone thing is interesting. It's an aspect of Prop 10 that we haven't really discussed. Costa-Hawkins prevents rent control being imposed on any single family residence.
Yes.
And those are the kind of rental properties, single family homes that Blackstone and other private equity firms have been buying up like crazy.
Yeah, we've done a story on that at Curb, and it is just astounding to see how many single family homes are being converted into rentals. Mostly because of what happened 10 years ago, the foreclosure crisis. Like, it's kind of crazy to see like how we have overbuilt our single family homes, and now we're not owning those, we're renting those back to people, right?
Yeah. And that also, I guess, informs for me a little. I've always kind of wondered why single family homeowners really even care about rent control. Just like, stay out of it, but
they shouldn't be allowed to vote.
But it does, I guess, this would theoretically devalue the earning potential, at least, of their properties if they were to decide to rent them out or sell them to some group that was going to rent them out.
That's a huge concern for a lot of homeowners. I mean, you guys have written about this. Like, that's like protecting your investment. That's a very terrifying thing to some people.
Yeah. I mean, so what the proponents would say to that is like, look, I don't think in any legitimate world, I have not heard any tenant groups say we want rent control on every single family home. What I've heard most of the tenant groups tell me is that if Costa-Hawkins were to go away and they wanted to do a rent control policy, it'd be something like, well, if you own four or more single family homes, or if you own a certain percentage, or if you're a publicly traded entity and you own single family homes, that's what we want to target. And your appealing Costa-Hawkins allows you to do that. But sort of to your point, there was a decision that tenant groups had to make about the kind of measure they wanted to have. Was it, we're going to do this to repeal a thing, which we talked about before, there's some complications with that, or would you want to prescribe some form of rent control in some way or the other? But obviously, if you do that, then there's other complications, other political fights that you have to do to, at least in your own side, in terms of coalition building, and you make more enemies than you otherwise would. Right. And so it was a tough choice. This is what they came to. You could certainly see some advantages of it. We'll let locals decide. It's a simple message. Right. But that's also runs into some of these problems where you can be open to attacks like, well, you're going to screw my, you know, my grandma out of her right. out of her earning potential.
It's simultaneously the most innocuous path and the most extreme.
Yes.
Where the way they did it, repealing Costa-Hawkins, doesn't technically do anything.
Right.
But it could do everything.
Yeah. I'm really curious.
There's your tagline for your billboard. Right.
Yeah, that's a great slogan. Yeah.
Liam and Matt, to get your guys' take on this. So what do you think from the perspective of the state legislature, what might people expect to see from our legislators if Prop 10 passes or if it doesn't pass? Do you think that we'll see follow-up legislation if it goes down in defeat, or is this kind of like a one-stand thing where if it goes down, we won't hear about rent control in the state capitol?
That is a literally $100 million question. That's a very, very good question. So I'll defer to Liam and then I'll follow up.
Okay. So I think the first question is, in my mind, is not necessarily what the legislature would do if Prop 10 fails, but rather what the apartment association would want if Prop 10 fails. Because they're going to have a ton of more leverage than they have now. And they have to decide. But I don't think this discussion, even if it fails, and even if it fails by a decent-sized margin, is going to go away. You're already having a ton of local fights. I would expect more of them to come, even with the existing Costa-Hawkins regime. And so the apartment association could say, look, we have some leverage now because we've won this battle. Either we're going to say, that's it, we're done, you guys go home, we won. Or they say, oh, okay, this is not going away. Let's have a conversation about things that we're willing to give up from a position of strength, and how that would get wrapped into sort of a larger conversation about housing that I certainly expect to happen with the new governor in office next year. I think that's certainly a possibility.
I think a lot will depend on, and let's just assume for the moment that Newsom gets elected, which it looks like it will, or looks like he will. A lot will depend on his kind of grand housing strategy. When Villaraigosa was running in the primary, he kind of explicitly laid out, I'm opposed to Prop 10, but I want to have rent control and Costa-Hawkins repeal as a negotiating chip that I can include in a broader housing package. Newsom hasn't been so explicit, but I wouldn't be surprised if something like that emerges. That being said, if this goes down and if this loses and loses big, the apartment association is going to be not incredibly willing to give a ton of ground. You know, it's just they're like, well, Californians clearly aren't a fan of this, and they're pro Costa-Hawkins, and why the hell should we give an inch?
But I think there is still a lot of political capital to be gained on a city level.
Yes.
In a place like LA, especially. And pushing for rent control or tenant protections in general. So I don't know if this doesn't work. Maybe the Ellis Act, which allows for more evictions, is the next target for tenant groups. I'm not really sure, but we should talk about this. Could be an avocado in its own right.
Two avocados.
Yes, this is it's two shows.
Two avocados. One, that would be an avocado a week if you had two in a fortnight.
True.
You could have one per week. So
there was a landlord in LA, Rampart Property Management, I believe, that sent a letter to
It's Rampart, literally.
Yeah, it's Rampart. Yes.
Hey,
yes.
it's a neighborhood. Sorry, it's a street. It's a neighborhood.
Scandal.
Yeah, we can't get away from it. It's unfortunate,
such good brand equity.
Yeah, already it's the one you would choose to head your property management company. It's great.
They sent a letter to all of their tenants saying, "Hey, we are announcing a rent increase in anticipation of Prop 10 passing, and if it fails." If it passes, we'll keep the rent increase. If it fails, we will. I think it said strongly consider.
Yes,
they didn't guarantee it,
but it was like we will strongly reconsider. Yeah.
Yes.
I think one of the things that I told you, Hazen, and Liam was that the same thing happened to my father in reverse in the 70s when Prop 13 was on the ballot, and his landlord said, if Prop 13 passes, I'm going to get such a huge tax break that all of my tenants, I won't raise your rent for the rest of the time that you live here. So go out and vote for Prop 13.
Isn't that like what Donald Trump's dad did when he was a landlord as well? I think it was similar.
So my dad wouldn't have been allowed to be one of Fred Trump's tenants, though.
So fun fact about Prop 13 and rent increases. There is a strain of thought that the modern or initial rent control measures that are in LA and in the Bay Area came after Prop 13 because tenants did not get the savings that they were promised.
Ooh,
after Prop 13.
Good twist. Yeah.
So that's where it was like, well, homeowners got something. Where's my thing? And that's how a bunch of measures passed late 70s, early 80s.
Interesting. But also interesting because rent control was really popular at first, I think, in like the Santa Monica's and West Hollywood, like in the west side of LA,
right,
which was also where Prop 13 was extremely popular. So despite the NorCal bias in the state house and some would say on the Gimme Shelter podcast, we've been very influential down here in LA on some of these very dramatic propositions.
You know, the power right now is all Southern California. You know, the legislative leaders, the previous leader of the Senate was from LA, the current one's San Diego, leader of the Assembly, LA. Prior to that, San Diego, and right. So it's all
next,
down south.
Next stop, getting somebody elected to state office.
Governor. We have Javier Becerra. That's the one
representative we have up there.
I mean, can we talk really briefly about the prospects of the new governor? I mean, is his housing agenda an agenda? I mean, I think people consider his ethos to be aligned with Jerry Brown, but I heard this ad for John Cox the other day that was like homelessness, traffic, wealth inequality all happened on Jerry Brown's watch. The same will happen with Gavin Newsom. I mean, there is something to be said about that. And how do we reconcile that? I mean, how do we, not that I'm voting for John Cox, but how do we know he's going to do anything different, and how, and do we know even what he stands for is what my biggest questions are.
So I like holding people accountable to things that they say. And Gavin Newsom has said something very big on housing, which is that he wants developers in the state to build 500,000 new homes every year for 7 years. Which, to put into context, since the business industry began keeping track of housing permits in the mid-1950s, the most it's ever been done in 1 year is 320,000. So he wants 500,000 a year for 7 years in a row, which is an insanely high number, right?
Right.
And I think what that means is you have to tackle, if you have any chance of tackling getting close to that number, you have to take on one of the three sort of third rails that I think exists in California politics in this issue: changing Proposition 13, changing the rules under the California Environmental Quality Act, which is an environmental regulation that most developments have to go through, that could take a long time to proceed through. And talking about local control over housing approvals. And
can
so
I name one more one yeah. that we don't talk about enough, I think, yeah. is Article 34. In the California yes. state charter.
It's in the Constitution.
California Constitution that yes. says basically that cities are not allowed to build affordable housing without putting it up for a vote on the city ballot. Passed in the 50s. It was a totally anti-poor, right. very racially charged constitutional amendment, and we don't talk about repealing it enough. I personally think
you're right. It's shocking how little attention that gets. I mean, to be clear, people have found workarounds and ways around that, and but yes, you're right. I mean, I think that's certainly, with respect to our history, something that we have not yet reckoned with.
I think to give a little bit more even perspective from an LA standpoint, Garcetti, our mayor in LA, in 2015, I want to say, had an ambitious goal for housing that I think got a lot of news at the time, which was to build 100,000 units in LA over a span of, I think, 6 years. So like 15,000 units a year. So just like paltry in comparison to what Newsom thinks is possible. I agree with you. There needs to be one of those four major third rails in California politics would have to be addressed. Do you think, or I guess I should say, which do you think is least daunting among those four to even take a swing at?
Ooh, that's tough. That's really tough.
It's a murderer's row of things that will get you drummed out of office.
Yeah.
Or kill your presidential campaign in
exactly.
4 years.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And one of the other points that's important to keep in mind is, you know, housing is an issue that you're not going to cure in a 2 year time span, a 4 year time span, maybe even a decade, right? Especially here in California. So if you do, and this was a point that one of Liam's colleagues at the LA Times made, which I thought was a good one. If you do have presidential aspirations and you want to show what you are able to get done, maybe housing is not what you stake your political capital on. In terms of the reformable third rails, I guess if gun to my head, maybe CEQA reform. Out of the ones that have been described, I mean,
someone will take you up on that.
Put the actual gun to your head.
Should we explain that? What CEQA reform would look like?
You guys have talked about it a lot more than we have.
I mean, maybe for our listeners.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So the CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act. It is often praised by environmentalists as the state law that has made California have breathable air and drinkable water and a bunch of other environmental benefits that that we enjoy. On the flip side, it is often abused to delay or outright obstruct and prevent the construction of new housing, be it market rate or affordable housing. You talk to any developer and they will bore you to tears with CEQA stories. And it's often abused in a way where, you know, a rival developer is going to invoke CEQA to stop a project. A labor union who wants to get on the action tries to stop a project. A good example in L.A. is Bombers moved to make a Clippers arena in Inglewood. There's a CEQA threat from the Great Western Forum, which may be not so much concerned with the environmental implications of a new arena, but more the economic downside to them if that gets built.
And they've said as much, basically, yes, that it is an economic thing, but they are still using CEQA because it's a tool at their disposal they can use
to
halt.
It's a huge amount of leverage for anyone who doesn't want something to happen.
Exactly. And so there have been efforts recently to abridge CEQA or sidestep CEQA that have been successful. So SB 35, which was a piece of legislation by Scott Wiener, Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco last year, if you built a project that included a certain percentage of affordable units and met a bunch of other requirements, you could avoid the CEQA process. So that's why, I mean, compare that to anything that's really been done on Prop 13, like,
right,
at least some small thing has happened with
we
with
do
CEQA.
Have so I think it is interesting because we have SB 35 as a sort of incipient CEQA reform. We also have seen an attempt at reforming local control over zoning with SB 827, also Scott Wiener from San Francisco last year.
That's right.
That did go down in defeat. However, Scott Wiener said that he would bring back a revised version of it this upcoming year. So
yeah,
we
will happen. Yeah.
So we have two of the third rails are, you know, people are losing their fear of going, at least one person is losing their fear of going after these previously untouchable state laws.
So to
it's
your
really
point,
just Scott Wiener, though, right?
But he's got people on board.
He does,
with him.
But sure. I mean, I feel like he's really taking the hits for a lot of. We can go back right. to this too as well. But he's taking a lot of the like political hits from this as well.
So to your point on CEQA or changes or reforms, I mean, there have been a lot that have been proposed and actually passed in the last 10 years or 15 years. But the problem with a lot of these is that they're written so specifically just to deal with every interest group that cares.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
and has the most money.
Right. At the end of the day, there's one or two or zero or four or five projects that it can actually meet all the requirements. And then you can sue over whether the particular project actually met all those requirements to bypass the CEQA review process. And so by sort of forcing everything into this small box, people can say, yes, we reform CEQA, but the reality is the smaller you make the box, the fewer the projects can actually fit.
And I wonder, too, because we also had, I think, a lot of people, myself being somebody who has been active in trying to get people to vote for Prop 10 locally here in L.A., full disclosure, I think that...
Did you call me?
Yeah, you didn't knock on my door.
You guys are... I was in Hollywood. You guys are in ritzier areas, I guess. So, but as far as that goes, I think that a lot of tenants' rights activists or people concerned with the housing crisis from a left-oriented perspective had seen Prop 10 on this year's ballot sort of as a way to gin up popular excitement yep. for a run at split roll in 2020, which is something that we know is coming.
Split roll being
this notion that you would tax property differently based on whether or not it was commercial or residential. Prop 13 gives huge tax breaks to property owners, irrespective of what kind of property it is. So you end up with a lot of businesses that are saving extraordinary amounts of money relative to what their properties are worth. Split roll would make it so that commercial properties would be assessable almost the way that they are other places in the country. And it would be a major increase for owners of businesses and things like that, but it would not touch the residential side of things. However, Prop 13 is kind of like the, for lack of a better comparison, like the Omar from The Wire. Like
Hell
if you,
yes. you
come at the king, you best not miss
exactly.
sort of thing. Yes. So I kind yes. of wonder how people are going to feel if Prop 10, you know, that was sort of the lead up to trying to do this major split roll thing. No one has really attempted. Jerry Brown, I think, famously said, you know, he got tired of trying to dream about reforming Prop 13, and it was something that he had given up on politically. So I wonder what happens to the momentum for that if Prop 10 doesn't pass.
So what's interesting about the split roll initiative that you just mentioned is that it looks like it's going to qualify, which is yeah. the first, I mean, there's been talk about this for decades, but the first time it looks like it actually will have enough support to get on the ballot, which is a hurdle. They can always pull it, as we've seen a lot, and Hayes referenced earlier to other ballot measures, this could go away. And so I don't think it definitely was going to appear, particularly maybe, I mean, that changes the calculation on what happens with Prop 10 maybe or something else, whether there's enough support, and it would have to come from unions predominantly. I don't really see any other financial supporter for this to really go all in to combat what would be an ocean of money from business groups to prevent it.
Can you talk about why unions might support split roll?
So more state money means more union workers.
It's a good reason to me.
And higher wages.
Yes.
We missed a good transition earlier. We're talking about Scott Wiener, who is going to be our guest.
Wow. Oh.
On our next episode. A lot of people coming down from Sacramento to kiss the ring. You're noticing. So that we're actually kind of going to, he happens to be passing through town and we're going to go to him.
We're actually going to like ambush him on the street, probably
yes.
on
yeah,
his way
that's
between
right.
speaking engagements.
But we'll talk about 827 part two.
What are they going to call it? 827 The Return. They got to rename it,
something
right?
Sinister
How does that
like
work?
That, sure.
Maybe you guys could come on another time and just explain the legislature,
numbers?
Just everything, like how everything works. Because I think
even
a basic like explainer on how our state government works, which I don't fully understand
yeah,
at all.
Great.
That would be really great.
So, quick thing on the numbers: the numbers start over every 2 years.
Whoa!
What?
Yeah.
That
yeah,
doesn't
yes.
make any sense. Why?
Well, because it's a 2-year session.
Oh,
yeah. So,
okay.
So the next version of 827 will be a lower number.
Okay, so guess what would it be?
I don't know.
Four.
But there are some legislators who reserve certain numbers for particular bills.
Is there a ceremony like SB1 was the gas tax? Was that
right.
them being like, this is like the big one? Like,
yeah, like how does that work? Do you buy your way to
no
the top?
Way that was just an accident.
Like, how does that work?
So there was an effort for something to change labor laws for contractors. The legislator who wanted to do that really wanted AB 1099.
Oh, cute.
That's funny.
Who wants 69?
We'll leave that for the explosion of what was explosion?
Syphilis?
Yeah.
Syphilis explosion.
Yeah. I feel like we didn't ask you guys any questions. So
okay,
I'm just
go for it.
Because we just talked a lot.
Go for it.
Yeah, ask one.
Sure. So I think you guys kind of referenced this, and me growing up in LA, I kind of felt this too. It seems like the housing crisis in California is viewed through a Bay Area lens. And I think that's somewhat unfair. I'm wondering if you guys agree with that and what kind of specific examples you guys have of that.
I have the example of having muted every person from San Francisco on Twitter.
For my quality of life, I have to do that at some point as well. I know way too much about the infighting up there. But I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, I think A27 Part 1 was directed very specifically at San Francisco, changing zoning up there. And I think it came as kind of a shock when people in L.A. were really against, to Scott Wiener, who put it forward, when people in L.A. were really not in favor of it because of what it would do in parts of South L.A. I think one reason why it's viewed through a Bay Area lens is something we lament on here a lot. Same reason everything is viewed through a Bay Area lens, because Bay Area politics are just a lot more contentious. There's so much grievance up there. There's so much fracturing. You can actually take sides with your Bay Area, with your like San Francisco supervisors. You can be a progressive. You can be a mod. You can have a team that you root for. What team? We don't have any teams here in our city council.
You don't have any team. I saw a good team this morning at the NACTO conference, I will have to say.
No, you have teams among activist groups, but you don't have.
No, maybe not. We had council members speaking at the NACTO conference this morning. So we had three council members talking to the National Association of City Transportation Officials conference, which was happening here in LA. And we had Nuri Martinez, Jose Huizar, and Marquise Harris Dawson on stage, all talking about the benefits of making improvements for pedestrians and vulnerable street users in their districts. And I was like, this is a good team.
Yes. When it comes to road diets and transit.
But also housing. I think they're the same. There's a team that's
mostly the same people.
Yeah, it's mostly the same people.
Well, they need names.
I think that my
superhero names.
San Francisco has names.
What do you mean?
Oh, that supervisor's a mod. That's what they say there. Am I wrong?
That's what they say up there.
Right. From my perspective, I think that a big part of the reason why I guess I don't know why the Northern California part of the state seems like incapable of grasping what's happening in Southern California. But I feel like that's the case. We mentioned SB 827, of course, with Scott Wiener proposing a broad blanket upzoning of certain types of properties. They were defended again in Northern California by defended against passage by tenants' rights groups who were saying, these people in LA agree with us. But I felt like only really in extremely broad strokes can you even begin to make LA's housing crisis look like San Francisco's. The actors are very different here as opposed to in San Francisco. Here, there is no boogeyman of tech companies or
in Venice, the Venice.
But yet they
has
are.
A,
they have just as big of a presence here, which is
but,
kind
but
of.
But it's localized. It's localized.
Yeah.
It's hyper localized.
It's not downtown.
When you talk about tech companies moving into Venice, which had already been subject to an extreme amount of gentrification, it's not the same as comparing the Mission, which is again, it is mind-boggling if you actually commit yourself to the task of trying to make Los Angeles resemble San Francisco. San Francisco is a tiny fraction of the size of Los Angeles. The Mission represents the heart of Hispanic culture in San Francisco. I defy you to name one place in Los Angeles that exemplifies that here. It's not possible. Venice has seen an influx of tech money and they are this like companies like Snap are pushing out millionaires, you know, like that's where Julia Roberts lives. It's not like they are the aggrieved, marginalized community that maybe that's the case in the Bay Area.
Yeah, not anymore because the millionaires pushed them out.
It's just what we see in Los Angeles is much more. I think one of the best descriptions I've seen of Los Angeles is that it is a Sun Belt economy grafted onto a Rust Belt economy. So we have a lot of the issues of the parts of America that are dealing with loss of manufacturing jobs, stagnating and even declining wages and things like that, along with a Sun Belt service industry. And I would go even further to say a huge non-citizen population that is completely disenfranchised. So we have all of this stuff going on. It's actually a much more complicated situation, I think, than what's happening in Northern California. And of course, every location has their own history with racism, segregation, and disinvestment. So it's hard to parse our housing crisis through the lens of San Francisco, vice versa. The opposite is, of course, true. But I do hope that people spend more time trying to learn about what is happening in Los Angeles on its own terms.
Great way to do that would be listening to this show.
I would never suggest that. But yeah.
Do you agree with that? You spend a lot more time in Northern California than we do.
Visiting? I talk to those people. I haven't muted them on Twitter, but not yet.
I'm petty.
But I will say that I think your comment was exactly right. I mean, again, we have to blame the sprawl in a way. And the fact that when we talk about San Francisco, we rarely talk about Oakland and Berkeley and Cupertino and all these other cities, which are the same geographic area as, you know, all of Los Angeles. So it's very hard to encapsulate what happens in a 8x8 mile pocket of the world and compare it to anywhere else, much less this grand city of Los Angeles.
Thank you guys for joining us. Thank us for joining you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Liam, you have to catch a train.
I do.
You're going down to San Diego, which really gets a short end. And
no one ever talks about San Diego.
It's a giant city.
It's so big. It's like a top 10 city.
Yeah, and it's crazy.
You know, yeah.
Anyway, we got to do this again.
This is wonderful.
Let's do it.
Yeah. We'll come to you next time.
Awesome.
Thanks,
thank
guys.
You.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.